Well, the journalist and writer Linda Kintzler grew up not knowing much about her Latvian grandfather, other than that he disappeared after World War II. It was only later, as an adult, that she learned Boris Kintzler had been a Nazi collaborator and a member of the SS in Latvia. After the war, he became a KGB agent and then vanished. In search of answers about her paternal grandfather, Linda uncovers his links to a man called Herbert Sukers, known as the Butcher of Riga, implicated in the murder of 30,000 Jews in Latvia. Sukers would later become the only Nazi known to have been assassinated by Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. But what unravels in her research and in her book, Come to This Court and Cry, How the Holocaust Ends, is a tale of revisionism, ultra-nationalism and denialism, issues that are just as timely as ever. And Linda Kintzler is with us from Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So we begin with the personal story and then we get into much wider themes. But can you tell us some more of your family's background, where they're from, and how this sets the scene for your book?
Yes, of course. You know, I think many of us in our families, you know, we begin with a vague idea of who our ancestors were and what they did. And for me, that was especially true, given that my family on my father's side came from Latvia, and on my mother's side, they were Jews from Soviet Ukraine. And so I grew up mostly in a Soviet Jewish context in the United States, speaking Russian with my family, attending Jewish day school. And it was only later, you know, I always knew that my paternal grandfather had disappeared after World War II and didn't really think much of it, you know, because that was a very, you know, common fate for people, for men from that part of the world in the mid-20th century. And it was only in this moment after the collapse of the Soviet Union when archives throughout the former Soviet Union were opened up, and with them, some truths began to emerge. And with those truths also came rumors and conspiracies to try to tie everything together. And so that's when we first kind of heard these rumblings that my grandfather, Boris Kintzler, had belonged to this unit, the RS Commando, which was one of the most infamous killing commandos of the Holocaust in Latvia. And basically, from that moment on, I tried to find whatever clues I could about the circumstances of his disappearance and when and why he might have started working for the other side, for the KGB.
We'll come back to Herbert Sukers in a moment. He has quite a place in Latvian history, and it is a contested place, which speaks exactly to your point of our need to be aware of documenting facts and the risk, often in nationalistic causes, of denial and reinventing facts. But can we stay with your grandfather's story? How were you able to research, and what did you learn?
Well, basically, I, you know, as with any story, you know, I put my journalistic training to work. You know, if you can't have obvious answers, if it's difficult to find, you start with the easier things, right? So I started looking at all of the archives I could find of the RS Commando, which was very well known. The lead of that unit, Viktor Zarais, was briefly in British custody right after the war, and then he also disappeared, and then was only recaptured later, living under a false name. And he died in prison in Germany after having served only 13 years in prison, I believe, which was a very paltry sentence given everything that he had committed. So I looked at his story, and I also, that of course was how I discovered the story of Herbert Sukers, and that is where I really thought, okay, this is a story that must be written, because not only was the fact of his death interesting to me, but I quickly discovered that his complicity was in the present. This was in 2015, the subject of an active criminal investigation in contemporary Latvia, such that the Latvian prosecutor general was really trying to investigate whether he could be found culpable for participating in war crimes. And so it took the past to the present for me. You know, it really underlined the fact that these things do not end, and also opened the door for me to discovering this really profound, I think, epistemological problem with how we understand the past and how we protect it against revisionism.
What did you learn, however, ultimately about your own grandfather's, the joining of the KGB after the war? Is there a possibility he'd, what, kind of double-agented the whole way? What, where were you
right.
able to finish his story?
Right. So, yes. Yeah, so we, the possibility is that he, there, that he could have been a double agent throughout the war. There is some evidence to suggest that four men who were part of that SS unit were in fact working for or reporting to at least the KGB. However, we do not know their identities. And all we can go off of is the fact that, you know, he survived the persecutions of those who had been complicit with German forces once the Soviets took over. So we have his records for the KGB after the war, and we know that he allegedly committed suicide in what was then a closed city in on the coast of Estonia. And what was really interesting was, you know, I petitioned the head KGB archive in Moscow for any information, and they said, "We're very sorry, we don't have anything." But then after the book was published, you know, someone reached out to me and said, "I think I might have information about your grandfather." And I, you know, said, "Okay, what is it?" And he said, "Well, my own father was serving in the Soviet military base where your grandfather allegedly disappeared." And he told the story in his memoirs of coming across a man who had committed suicide on the beach. And in the pocket of his trousers was a note that said, "I'm sorry, Major, I could not complete my mission." And so he reached out to me thinking, well, this was probably your grandfather. And this is just one of these things that I cannot know. You know, it sounds like a plausible story, but perhaps not.
It must be, obviously you're a journalist, obviously you're writing about very big and important themes in this book, but it's also very personal. You know, your mother's family, as we said, Ukrainian Jewish family. They were victims of the Holocaust. And at some level, you must be seeking an understanding of your ancestors, of your grandfathers, and you must be needing to walk in different people's shoes in a deeply uncomfortable way, Linda.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, it was quite jarring for me at the time to discover, you know, the realities of my grandfather's complicity, especially given the fact that my mother's family were among those who were murdered at the ravine in Babyn Yar in Ukraine. And, you know, that's kind of a duality that I have to inhabit, you know, and I think that's one of the only ways I could write this book. I wouldn't have written it, you know, under any other circumstances, right? It's not, I'm not looking for a redemptive story, you know, I'm looking to understand how you protect these records. And, you know, in some ways to do a service to the relatives of mine who were killed, to kind of contribute to, I don't know, a world in which their testimonies aren't constantly undermined. And so that's how I've been thinking about it, you know, and I think we're in this moment, I'm the third generation away from the events. So my emotional ties to it are less direct than those of my parents, but of course I've inherited it and I, you know, possess it in a different way. And I think I've been trying to be really cognizant of that the whole way through.
That distance, though, of generations is another concern you have, and we'll come to that. Herbert Sukas himself, however, who was its leader of this Aras Commando, he was mentioned, as I understand it, at the Nuremberg war crime trials, right? But what happened to him? He escaped, he got away to South America until Mossad tracked him down. That's the short story, yeah?
Yes, yes. So he didn't think that he had anything to hide. He lived in the open, unlike, you know, other Nazis whom listeners might have heard of, like Mengele and Eichmann, who traveled under false names to South America. Zukers did not. He was very open. He moved with his whole family. After they fled the Soviet advance, they fled to South America, to Brazil. And he very quickly tried to reestablish himself as a celebrity. He was a national hero in Latvia before the war, during the interwar period, because he was a famous aviator. And so in Brazil, he started taking interviews with newspapers. And that is how Jewish organizations quickly found out his whereabouts and sent surveillance personnel to take photographs of him. And so one of those photographs is on the cover of my book. And basically, you know, after Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped in Buenos Aires in 1960, Zuckers became suspicious and started carrying a gun. He got permission from Brazilian authorities actually to do so, which is just kind of a wild circumstance. And in 1965, he encountered this man named Anton Kunzle, who presented himself as a German business or Austrian businessman, himself a former member of a Nazi organization, who courted him. And Zuckers didn't know, of course, that the real name of Anton Kunzle was Yaakov Medad, and he was a Mossad agent whose mission was allegedly to kill him. But we don't know officially whether it was to kill him or perhaps to kidnap him and take him to trial.
However, he died, and there's no question of that. You mentioned
yes.
the fact that his death isn't the end of the story. This posthumous criminal investigation into his actions. Coming at it from what perspective? As you said, he'd been this aviator. He'd been this sort of hero, this sort of mythic figure, seen by some anyway, in Latvia. So from what perspective was this contemporary criminal investigation looking into his life?
Yes, I mean, that's a fascinating question. So, and I think you have to begin the story with the assassination itself, because it's one of these events that's very poorly known, but in legally, I believe it has, you know, quite important repercussions. The first of which is, of course, that on his body, the assassins left an excerpt of Sir Hartley Shawcross's closing speech at Nuremberg, the chief British prosecutor at Nuremberg, which testified in particular to the crimes that were committed upon the Baltic states. And the final line of that speech was, and that he addressed the judges, and he said that they should imagine that all of mankind stood before them, and that they had come to this court and cried, "These are our laws, let them prevail." And so the killing of Herbert Zuckers was explicitly done to call attention to the fact that law was not prevailing, and so they had to resort to these extrajudicial measures. What is interesting is that Zuckers' name was read into the record at the Eichmann trial in 1965, or in 1962, when a witness from Riga stood up and said, "You have to go and get this man." And so after that, you know, he kind of faded. The images of his murder graced the papers and then went away. And then, you know, I mentioned this period after the fall of the Soviet Union when things began to change, right? Things, archives began to open up, and all of a sudden it was possible for people to petition for the rehabilitation of their ancestors, people who might have been suppressed by Soviet authorities, sent to the Gulag, various things. And one of those rehabilitation requests was filed by Zuckers' daughter. And that is basically how this contemporary criminal investigation started to go underway, because the prosecutor is obligated to investigate any allegations of war crimes, of course. The fact that they were investigating the crimes of a man who by then had been dead for many decades does not preclude them from having to go through the investigation. And so that's how this journey began, really. And as with any investigation, there needs to be a decision rendered at the end of it. And unfortunately, the decision that the prosecutor originally came to was that, in fact, you cannot prove that Zuckers did anything wrong, that there's no remaining evidence that he was complicit in these crimes, despite the fact that we know he was a member of the commando. And so that's what I really zeroed in on as this extreme problem of revisionism that tries to take the established facts of what happened during the Holocaust and kind of rips the rug out from under them by mobilizing legal logic.
So it's the presumption of innocence that is being utilised here, and then an arguable lack of evidence that doesn't meet a certain threshold that could essentially see him, what, necessarily exonerated or just not reaching a threshold of being found guilty? I mean, what is the potential outcome?
Right. I mean, the answer is both, you know, and I think what is fascinating is because we're dealing with a region that only recently regained a system of independent law. So the rehabilitation procedures that I am discussing were inherited from the Soviet Union. And so there's this, you know, it's kind of a slippery case where, much like in, you know, in fact and in reality, the line between what is innocent and what is guilty, what is complicit and what is rehabilitated, is not clear. And so that's certainly one of the things I was calling attention to. The reality, however, is that because, you know, there have been various cultural efforts to rehabilitate Sukurs, it's, you know, as the criminal investigation was ongoing, there was a musical called Sukurs, Herbert Sukurs, that sought to glorify him. There was a museum exhibition that was literally called The Presumption of Innocence that sought to do the same, and which the prosecutor's office visited and took photographs of and entered into the record. And so, you know, right now, what is fascinating about my book underscores is that, you know, you can render these decisions and then the Jewish community successfully appealed it. And so it remains this open question. It kind of remains, you know, an active question in the community and in the courts for all of us to kind of resolve.
And then, of course, the court of public opinion, which is another matter altogether. Come to this court and cry. How the Holocaust Ends. This is Linda Kinstler's book. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Nationalism needs its heroes. And you're talking about former Soviet Union nations where, and this gets right to the heart of something dear to your heart, I know, right now, the histories are being debated and the histories are being challenged. And I'm referring specifically to Ukraine. Could you speak to your wider theme? That even two or three short generations distance from events risks the story being rewritten. And what do we need? Do we need utterly faultless documentation? What do we need to ensure that history is not rewritten in untruthful ways?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the points that I've been making ever since the full-scale invasion was unleashed upon Ukraine is that what happened in the 20th century in Eastern Europe, it hasn't been, you know, it's not like in Western Europe. It's not, it hasn't been sufficiently documented. There isn't a popular public understanding of what happened. It's not general knowledge, you know, and what is for me, you know, among many things so heartbreaking about what's going on right now is that we were just getting to this moment, you know, when a Russian missile strike hit the territory of Babyn Yar, finally Babyn Yar was going to get a museum complex that would have been a fulsome treatment of the horrors that had been committed there that was explicitly designed to make the Ukrainian public aware of what had occurred, you know, about complicity and victimhood in all dimensions of the catastrophe.
Just to explain to listeners not familiar the history at Babyn Yar.
Yes, so that was the largest Holocaust mass grave in Eastern Europe, where in 1941, occupying German forces murdered 30,000 Ukrainian Jews, and for the duration of the German occupation of Ukraine, Ukrainian nationalists, priests, hospital patients were all murdered there. So it's a site of collective mourning that had kind of been left to rot for many decades.
And then come back forward to what was just happening now. There was to be a museum. There was to be, as we said, this this documenting and memorialization of the event. And now?
And now it is recovering from a Russian missile strike which hit that same territory, burning to the ground several buildings, one of which was ironically supposed to be a museum to the Holocaust in Eastern Europe. And of course, I bring all this up because, as we know, The Russian government has insisted that this is a war to, quote, denazify Ukraine, which obviously is just one of the most perverse falsehoods you can imagine, but does underscore the risks of how widely history can be manipulated, right? And I just think this is one of the reasons why we need to work very hard towards documentation and justice in all of its forms, knowing that a single form, for instance, you know, domestic trials, which are already ongoing in Ukraine, is not sufficient.
Do you fear particularly propaganda, the rewriting of history, the different perspectives of history, but the blatant rewriting of history is not new. It has existed for as long as societies have. But do you fear for this particular time where there just seems to be this roiling, this challenge to any agreement, even within our societies, over facts, where we have people openly talking about alternative facts, you know, in a presidential campaign? Do you have a particular fear for these times?
You know, I do, but I also am willing myself to be hopeful. I think we're in a extremely delicate moment that in some ways, as you say, we've been anticipating for a long time. We've known that these things occur, that history is not stable by any means, but we are now solidly in the moment when the atrocities of the 20th century are passing out of memory and into history, which is to say that the last survivors are dying and also the last perpetrators are dying. And when that happens, you can no longer turn to a human and have them testify, this is what I saw. And insofar as, you know, we are seeing in various countries that historians are no longer free to write what they have found, that they are sometimes, you know, in Poland, for example, and in Latvia and in Lithuania, you know, you can be tried for sued rather for making certain allegations. And that's what scares me. That's this kind of reach of law back into the past, this kind of desire that we have to establish exactly what occurred and not to embrace this understanding that, you know, not everything should be subjected to legal logic, especially after decades after the fact. That is what scares me.
This is another matter just brought to my attention by a colleague. This is the BBC reporting that Russia's facing the mass migration abroad of large numbers of its Jewish population, at least one in eight leaving the country since its war with Ukraine beginning. And one can only speculate at the motivations for, you know, thousands, 20,500 of Russia's estimated total of 165,000 Jews having left since March.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is one of those things that you don't want to say, oh, it will be just as horrible as it will be in the past, but it might be more horrible. You know, it took a long time for my family to get out of the Soviet Union, and they were only able to once the leadership in the Kremlin decided to allow Soviet immigration to Israel. And that allowed a whole generation of Soviet Jews to have new lives. And so the idea that avenue, you know, would be closed is truly horrible to think about. And also given Israel's role in mediating between Russia and Ukraine in this conflict.
Thank you, Linda Kinsler. The book is Come to This Court and Cry, How the Holocaust Ends,